this was a pretty big issue, both in terms of just content and with what I've seen from popularity. Like, I think this was this the biggest issue for the arc in terms of, like, the reader reaction?
Oh, that's a good question. This was a pretty big one. I don't know. They've all been... they've all gotten big responses in their own ways. You know, there's not one of them that I felt like... To me, the worst thing is no reaction. You know, like whether or not they're pleased with the issue or not, it's more just that they're talking about it. And there really wasn't an issue of this arc that I felt like there wasn't a ton of response to, but this was certainly up there. I think that what was fun about the reaction to this one is because it's primarily two people in a room, I was nervous about it in the sense that I was worried that people were going to be like, oh, it's like 30 pages of talking heads, you know, and that kind of thing. Thankfully, it didn't play out that way at all. You know, people seemed to really get what we were doing here, and people seemed to really enjoy kind of stopping some of the craziness and having a conversation for a minute about it.
That was actually going to be my next question, is that when you were putting together what it's not a talking heads issue, but, you know, it really is outside of the flashbacks. It's just two people in a room chatting. And honestly, you know, I can find that to be really compelling, especially when you have a large, you know, mystery story of this fashion. But was there any sort of, you know, you've already noticed that you're kind of afraid. Was there any sort of specific way you chose to approach this?
No, I mean, the one great advantage that we have as a book over pretty much everything else is just we do a lot of pages per issue. And, you know, really all the credit for that goes to Joe, who's fast enough and hardworking enough and cares enough about the story to do that. And that gives me the ability to make the scripts 1,000 times better than they would be if I had to do them in 20 pages. So that, I think, in and of itself helps us a lot because you know it's going to be a long read regardless, and a substantial read, and so much of the reader and audience evaluation that comes these days is based on the sort of cost per minute ratio, which I have my own problems with, you know, in terms of that, that is an idea of value, but regardless, it is a popular way to evaluate comics these days, and I knew that between the flashback sequence that we had set out here, and you know, the meat of the conversation. I felt like we could get away with it, but yeah, there were some nerves, and then, but then, like I said, I think we benefited to some extent from the craziness of 15 and 16. You know, that those were very fast paced issues where a lot happens, and they were issues that were very loud. So I think that the readers were kind of ready for a moment where maybe we did breathe in a bit. And, you know, thankfully, I think a lot still came out of it.
So as we open, we get a rather sad sequence that we've actually kind of seen before.
Right.
Which is the death of Jade's mother.
Right.
And I believe the last time we saw it in issue number 10, Crit and I both sort of called that we'd probably see this exact sequence again in, you know, in that this is like a repeat memory for her. But, sure. You know, the question I have is about the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the dialogue in issue number 10 was different because the Jade of that dream sequence didn't really comprehend what was going on.
Right.
But when you were bringing that back, was there any challenge to sort of make that dialogue work, or did you write that dialogue in advance and then kind of cut it up for later?
Yeah, no, I knew what the dialogue was going to be. I didn't actually script it out, but I knew the beats. You know, like I knew what the back and forth was. So yeah, I would never set a trap for myself quite like that. You know, I have to have a general idea of where the conversation is going. So yeah, it wasn't terribly difficult.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a pretty gruesome sequence. I think we touch upon this a bunch of times already, but you know, violence at the school is perceived differently than violence not at the school.
Well, I can top that with this.
Yeah.
Because see, that is a good example of sort of what the audience will accept in a moment. Because what you just said, that, you know, this is feels more gruesome because it's not at the school. Remember that the first time that we saw this sequence, actually, they're driving through mass devastation and there are bodies and bones everywhere piled up all along, you know, all along the way. And, you know, that we see sort of mass devastation, and horror. But when you replay it in this, environment where, you know, it's sort of a sunny, idyllic day, and then, you know, you have one of your speaking characters die. It's interesting, you know, how that will have more of an effect. And it just really goes to show that so much of empathy is based on what we can keep our attention to. So it's just sort of an interesting kind of experiment in how the reader views violence or carnage or death.
Yeah, I was gonna say when they're, you know, they're driving through like a wasteland of decay, it's, you know, it just kind of is.
right, you know? right. One body in the middle of the road of a character that's been talking is sometimes, you know, is much more jarring than you know, mass graves. That's just the way that heads respond to these kinds of things. And it's always fascinating to me, like how you know, how we can position these things differently. And this is an example of attempting to do that. You know, that the horror now is not outside, the horror is comes from the inside, and you know, hopefully it has more impact that way.
So as we go into, you know, our room conversation, you start it with these eight panels or seven panels of silence.
Mm-hmm.
Were you, I mean, I figured this was pretty much just you letting Joe have fun with character faces and expressions and whatnot.
Yeah, I gave sort of beats of what they were thinking, and Joe really nailed it. You know, he did a fantastic job, and it's just a fun kind of awkward moment between two people who haven't spent a lot of time together, and the time that they have spent hasn't been very good. And I wanted to have a little fun with a sort of awkward high school moment. I think sometimes as things in the book get crazier and crazier and more happens, it's really important to, as often as we can get away with, reconnect with the fact that these are teenagers and that this is a high school. And this was kind of one of those moments.
So what I like about this sequence, and I'm totally going to make a pun here just because I can.
Okay.
But it would appear that Ike is very jaded by this situation that he's presented
sure.
in. you know, we definitely talked about this before, but this is kind of like the quintessential, or it's like your version of the, I think, the man of science, man of faith idea, just kind of put on the page with these two characters.
Yeah, they are our closest stand-ins in that sense. You know, the this is the closest we'll probably ever get to that dynamic. So, and again, like we discussed earlier, I'm not very interested in doing another story where somebody's skepticism and centeredness blinds them to things directly in front of them. That's something that you know, I've seen pulled off very well in fiction, and it's just not something that I want to make an attempt at. By the same token, we're still early in the experience for these kids. We may not be that early in terms of issue numbers, but we're still early in terms of their interaction with these things at the Academy. And so not all of them have seen things that defy rational explanation. So, and Ike is very much at that point right now. He really hasn't seen anything that he can't explain his way out of.
With this entire sequence, and I am like 100% positive we talked about this on the last ARCs podcast, but I can't remember the specific answer. You know, what is, we sort of talked about your opinion on skeptics and about having this sort of grand mythology of it all, but in terms of actually incorporating, you know, religion into the book, is this something that you are sort of comfortable bringing in, that you are not fond of, but still bring in? Because, you know, they go into the whole story of Job later here, which is, right, you know, one of the famous biblical stories. And obviously there's a big religious connotation surrounding Ike at the moment.
Right. Yeah, it's one of these things that's beautiful about working in comics, is if you touch that third rail of religion too often in another medium, you could be actually seeing a lot of negative press for it, or you could have people protesting, you could have advertiser issues and that kind of thing. And in comics, you know, because of the nature of the medium and because of the size of the audience, even though it's, you know, fairly sizable, it's still not... It still doesn't penetrate to that extent that you have to deal with that kind of thing, and it gives us a lot of freedom to be able to be on the nose about it, where it doesn't have to be sort of just vague references to faith or belief in something more, that we can be very specific in our references, and that we can reference stories from the Bible and from other sources, and I can do that without you know, fear of too much reprisal, I guess. So yeah, I wanted this story to deal with religion in a very direct way. And religion is a key part, and it's not something that we're going to flinch from. I know that there are people who, when you start using it, they sort of, you know, clench up a bit and they get nervous, but, it's such a huge part of our world and such a huge part of our life experience, and you know, it really has shaped the course of human history, and in a story like this, it would be wrong to not spend a lot of time with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, he makes a sort of sassy remark here when she asks him if he believes in car and he believes in God.
Do you believe in cars?
This is a Vanilla Sky reference, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite movies.
Okay, I wasn't sure if I... Because there's a lot of things like that where you know, if I can't just straight up Google a line from a movie to make sure I'm correct, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
no, you got this right. This is a direct reference. There's a scene, spoilers, in Vanilla Sky, in which Cameron Diaz's character asks Tom Cruise's character David Ames if he believes in God, and about a minute later in the film, she takes a car off a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think the point's made.
Yeah. The other one here is he references Mayer philosopher. Is that supposed to be Stephanie Mayer, the author of Twilight?
Yeah. This is another Twilight reference.
All right.
Because by then I was like, well, I've already done it. So screw right. it.
I'll admit that I totally didn't get that reference. That I was actually looking up, like trying to find a philosopher.
Well, it's really funny that you say that, just because we talked before about me worrying about dating the book with a Twilight reference back in issue 2.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good example of time having passed, because by 17, I clearly don't think Twilight's going anywhere. I think that's the proof that it's pretty etched permanently in popular culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, I totally didn't get the author reference, but I think that's just because I am not a Twilighter. Crit had to point that one out to me to get it across. So with the we've sort of touched upon the religious aspect of it all, and it's hard to sort of nail down specific scenes. Mm. I think a lot of the discussion we could have on it is sort of more broad. But what I do like with this issue is that, you know, you're not really leading the readers down a specific path.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot in here that, you know, references things that have happened in previous issues that give it all new light, you know?
Sure.
Like Jade's, you know, you think I want to die, I have to.
Right.
Is a pretty big moment.
Yeah, it's a big moment. That's a big moment in terms of explaining Jade's motivation in some previous scenes. So we needed to talk about that. It's interesting because that's another example of, in comics, you know, there's been a lot of suicide imagery with Jade, and you know that's something that you can pull off in comics, you know, without it generating a great deal of controversy. But it was still very important to me that I felt like we were putting that into context. And that we were beginning to explain why that is what it is, because you talk about things that I worried about, you know, in terms of torture sequences and whatnot. Some of Jade's stuff has been the stuff that I've worried about the most, just in terms of people getting the wrong idea about why she does what she does. And so I wanted to, it was one of the first things that I wanted to accomplish in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. I also like that this issue actually gives us some time in Jade's past. Because
mm-hmm.
before, when, you know, when everyone was getting their own little flashback issue of sorts, she got an issue all to herself that did not reveal anything clearly.
Right. This is really our first straight-up look at her past since the first issue. Yeah. So it was something I was eager to get into. There's a lot more coming, but yeah, it's again, that's an example of having something from day one and having to wait to do it 17 issues in.
It's actually sort of through a lot of the dialogue in this issue, and you know, being able to look at her past, it actually has caused Crit and I to call issue number 10 the quote-unquote Dallas issue. if that makes sense.
Help me with this. Why is it the Dallas issue?
Well, you know, because Dallas very famously ended with a lot of these things that people didn't like. All being a dream.
Now, you know, we touched
upon this earlier with the timeline, you know, quote unquote problems between issues and whatnot. But, you know, that's very much the, we get to look at it and say like, oh, okay. So it's kind of sort of all a dream. And she sort of touches on that, how she says she sees these things, this weird stuff, and that she knows what she had to do.
Right.
One thing I do like, though, a lot, in fact, and I've noticed not a lot of writers do this, which seems weird to me, but, you know, it's something that when I see it done, I always really appreciate it. You know, these characters don't have any legitimate explanation of certain things.
Right.
They're experiencing it for the first time at the exact same time as we are, so they can't get any sort of additional information that we can't get. So when Jade talks about these things and she's referencing things, it's clear that she has just as much of an idea as, you know, say, the reader has.
Right.
Which is something that doesn't often happen, since oftentimes, you know, authors will put it in that a character knows more than they're letting on or something.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, all the kids here, you know, vary in terms of their level of knowledge, of things that are going on, and we're going to deal with this a little bit more early on in the fourth arc with Hunter. You know, it's something that I like reminding the reader of is how these things look through their eyes, and there's actually, you know, there are times where you realize that we, you know, that the audience know more than they do, than the characters. And it's sometimes that gets taken for granted. And I think that this part of the conversation really reflects it's important to ground things and, you know, remind the audience that, these kids haven't seen quite as much as we have. You know, at this point, Jade and Ike are sitting up here looking down at Casey and Lara, and it makes absolutely no sense. And it just seems like they're doing something odd and crazy. You know, Jade really has no inside information on anything of any kind. You know, outside of the stuff that's in her own head.
So, you know, as the story begins to push towards its end, and before we get into discussing the sort of, you know, really crazy bits about it, there's one thing that I felt is there and that I just couldn't find it. And that is, are we supposed to know why the shadows move on their own at this point?
No. You're just supposed to know that they're doing it.
Is there perhaps, like, hidden somewhere in this issue a reference to why they can do that on their own?
No, I can't think of one. I can't think of anything. But again, issue 20... issue 20, the next issue, we'll revisit some of these ideas.
Because I'd always assumed that based on the cover alone, that I was supposed to be able to figure out more than I could, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well.
So as we push towards the end, we get this nice moment where, you know, Jade and Ike really, really connect for the first time in this story outside of their conversation. Because, you know, up until this point, they've been, you know, lightly teasing one another, or it's very much a back and forth. I want to say almost an argument more than a discussion.
Sure.
But, you know, they connect at the end through the prayer, and, you know, it's almost, maybe the least subtle element of the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that remark?
Sort of.
All right. I'll take it. The other sort of connection that we are supposed to be able to assumedly make is that until they do this, this is the time where Casey is able to do her little trick here. That might
or might not be true. It could be that what Ike and Jade do here is what enables Casey and Lara to do what they do, or it could simply be chance. It could just be happening at the same time.
Somehow I'm gonna say that there's not many things in this book that seems that they just happen by chance.
Well, there's what happens by chance, and then there's what happens at the same time. So, you know, certain things could happen at the same time, but not necessarily be connected.
And I do seem to remember a reference to time moving differently below and above.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's something going on.
Well, I think one thing that you could probably piece together, just from looking at the two issues, is that Casey and Lara go down into the bottom of the cave and sit down, and for them that seems to happen very quickly. Whereas for Ike and Jade, you know, this is a fairly substantial conversation that they've had. You know, it's hard to measure it exactly in time, but it certainly wasn't just a few words and then looking down. You know, they had an in-depth dialogue, and some time where they just sat up there in awkward silence. So that's something that you could probably piece together here, is that the two things don't exactly match up.
Right. But what we do see here again is future Jade, more right. vomit, of course.
Right.
And the apparent...
Our one per issue quota at this point in the book.
You know, we talked about this in the last issue, but it would appear that for whatever is happening in the past, there is some sort of reaction to it along the timeline in the future.
Right. There might be a connection here, too.
You just never know.
It's hard to say. But it is weird that we chose to put two pages of that in at this point, then, if not, because otherwise it's pretty weirdly out of place.
Who knows? You might just be making it up as you go along.
Sure. But, you know, again, the stories of these, you know, however you want to say it, these quote-unquote two Jades, you know, is very important. You know, future Jade or however you want to refer to her, her story seems intimately linked to the Jade that we see more of. Mm-hmm. So they almost always come in pairs.
So the final revelation of the issue is that, you know, Abraham is still alive, that Ike did not kill him.
Right.
Which I think most of us probably could have put together on our own when Ike was sent back to his old room.
Right, when Ike gets his demotion and his eviction. Yeah. Yeah.
What people probably couldn't tell is that David, who makes his appearance here as well, is also his son.
Right. Right.
So
big moment, it would seem, in terms of whenever you ask people sort of like, what are the number one things about the book that you want answers to? It's really funny to me that to this day, 19 issues later, people will still say the cylinder, and they'll still say David. That even though we haven't seen the cylinder in ages, and we rarely have seen David, it just really goes to show that whatever you drop in front of somebody first, it's going to be the things that stick with them forever. So first impressions on that front. And yeah, it's pretty big moment.
So, you know, is it, we'd never really seen any great connection with David with anyone except for Zoe.
Right.
And this addition of it being with Abraham too, we knew that Abraham visited Zoe when she was young. So it's not too out of the blue to perhaps believe that at one time Abraham was a foster parent for Zoe, would you say? And perhaps her and David grew up together. It's the least subtle I've been in a while, I think.
right. Everybody understands that we record all these together, right? So at this point, Matt is just like, screw it, just tell me what's going on. It's been like 5 hours, dude. Well, what we saw in the scene with Zoe when she's a little girl is Abraham tells his guide to let the couple know that that he's found her daughter, and that her name is Zoe. So we do know that Abraham is directly responsible for how Zoe comes to live in San Diego, and we do know that they have that very early interaction, and that Zoe recognizes him even then, you know, that Zoe recognizes him despite it being the first time that they've met. So we're still obviously not at the point where we can make the connection, but obviously there is something that interlinks the three of them, right?
If Abraham has two sons, it's not far out of the mind's reach to believe that the two sons are familiar with one another.
Hard to say. We don't know yet. yeah, it's obviously, look, the story of Abraham is, and I've talked about this before, it's become such a crucial part of the overall narrative, and we're going to spend a lot more time with it over the next few arcs. So we've got a lot still to cover and a lot to connect. I think it's going to be a really, really rewarding story. It's the investment that people have in those characters in that story. You know, it's big time stuff. So I'm excited with where we're going.